Welcome back to HealthLink On Air, produced each week by Upstate Medical University and University Hospital. Linda Cohen, along with my guests, Dr. Henry Rowan and Heather Cady. They work with autistic children using applied behavioral analysis techniques. And right before the break, we were talking about how when children have no way of communicating, they engage in some of these maybe self-destructive or other destructive behaviors. Reminds me of the Helen Keller. I recently saw a production of The Miracle Worker, and she was doing all of those kinds of things, pinching people, knifing people. I mean, she was doing everything until we had somebody who, the miracle worker, Annie Sullivan, who sat down and recognized that there was a world in there that needed to be unlocked. Mm-hmm. Sounds like some of what you're doing.
Well, I'm not a miracle worker, but yeah, I think that's really it. You really have to work through the problem behavior, and it sounds kind of cliche, but it truly does get worse before it gets better. And you don't just get this generalized effect simply because the kids come into clinic. It takes quite a bit of while. And if you think about it from the kids' perspective, they might have a 7-10 year history of kind of their problem behavior in a way being advantageous. And it's kind of weird to think, why would hitting yourself be advantageous? But if you don't have language and that's the surefire way to get to kind of control things, and certainly they're not manipulative, but if you kind of can think about it that way, yeah, whether it's attention or you don't want to have to do your schoolwork or you want to play with that toy that your sister has, and any good parent says, oh my gosh, my kids hurt themselves, what can I do to make this stop? And that's what happens. And certainly that's not to cut on the parents, but you have that kind of rule that the kid learns, and then you change it up on them. Well, then they've got this history where it's all of a sudden like, man, that's not working for me anymore. I'm mad. They have an emotional outburst, and all of a sudden they get more variable in their behavior. Maybe they do things. We had a young woman who, when we went to treatment, she started to disrobe. And that's, it really upset the mom. It upset me. It's an adolescent girl in my clinic disrobing. That's not good. But that's something she had never done before. But if you think about it from her perspective, the behaviors that usually kind of quote work for her no longer work because we're in treatment. And so she gets more variable. She starts to do these other things.
So let's go back, just start really quickly, just to reiterate. You get a kid, They have some of these behaviors, whether it's biting themselves or hurting someone else. You did say earlier in the show that you would have someone watch very carefully and take a very careful analysis of their behavior and what makes them, when they do things and why they seem to do things. Mm-hmm. Then what's the next step? What do you do?
The first thing we do is we sit down with the parents and create goals for the kids. What are their concerns? So it's not my job to tell them what we ought to be working on. I want to deal with what the parent wants. So we had a little girl who she was very controlling in terms of what other people could and couldn't do. But the number one concern for the mom was being able to go out in public with her. Mom hadn't been able to take her out in public for over a year because of her behavior. And so that's something I didn't necessarily see right off the bat, but that was what was important with her. That's what we started with. Every case is obviously quite different, but generally what we start with is an assessment called functional analysis. And essentially what we do there is attempt to replicate problematic situations in a clinic environment. So we sit down, we say, what are the problem situations that your little kid's having, and how do we then replicate that in a clinic in a controlled setting?
So the context and what are the triggers for the behavior?
Right. And so I might be in there working directly with the child, putting the child in situations that might trigger behavior and contrasting those with situations that might not. And that's essentially a test, much like if you go to an allergist and they test you with different things and see how you're going to react to it. While I might be doing that, Heather would be taking data. We would look at the frequency with which the child displayed behavior in one context over another. And then when we see the context that's associated with the most problem behavior, that tells us what we need to intervene on.
So then you set up a series of what? Steps to try to change that behavior.
Typically what we have to do is teach the child a replacement behavior. Most often that's the form of communication. So it's not that, you know, maybe a kid does talk and maybe they speak in full sentences, but the point is to teach them a response that works as well as their problem behavior works. And when you do that, the easiest way to do it is to make sure that the problem behavior sort of doesn't pay off anymore. And so then you set it up where the functionally, the kid has kind of a choice. I can either continue to do the bad behavior, but that's not going to pay off anymore, or I can do this other behavior, and that will pay off for me.
Pay off in what way?
They get what they want. I mean, a kid responds in an appropriate way, and we throw a party for them. You know, we are like, oh, my God, that's a great job asking. Everything else is water under the bridge. If you hit me five times before you asked, that's irrelevant to the fact that we saw that behavior we wanted to see, and that's what we're going to respond to.
So how long does it, first let me ask two other very quick questions. You said you usually work with kids around the age of 9. I know in Heather's case you work with younger children, mm-hmm. but if you were to have gotten these kids at 4 or 3, do you think that your job would have been that much easier?
Yes.
Okay, so absolutely. Earlier is better.
Absolutely.
And at the same time, how long does it take in the current setting for you to make a change, for you to see a change?
Several months.
How often?
Usually we see kids 5 days a week for an hour and a half. Now, that's a structure that we have in our clinic. The same children I'm working with here would be kids that in prior clinics we might have seen for 3 to 6 hours a day. And so you're able to move twice or four times as fast when you can see a kid that much longer. And it's certainly disruptive, more disruptive, if you see a kid for only a short block of time because they've got another 20-some-odd hours in the day where they're not in treatment. Exactly.
Yeah. So it's so labor-intensive. Clearly, what you're doing with the feeding, Heather, is also incredibly labor-intensive. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you need to get everyone in the family and the educational system. I mean, it's got to be, as I said, a global approach, as you said.
Yep.
But it's also incredibly costly. So how does that work? I mean, I understand right now you have more need then you have resources right here in your current situation. Is that correct?
Yeah, we have. We've never done any advertising or anything like that. We have about a 3 to 5 year wait list.
Wow.
In our current setting. And it actually, if we looked at it, I'm guessing it would be a little bit longer than that. We bill insurance under my psychology license. So I'm a licensed psychologist in New York State. I bill insurance just like anybody else would in their clinic.
But does insurance cover this kind of treatment?
Yeah.
It does.
Now, they don't cover insurance coverage for autism is a big deal right now. Actually, they had a bill yesterday that left a subcommittee in New York to go to the full Senate for voting on autism insurance.
On the basis of the state, you're talking about the state legislature.
Yeah, on the state. Yep. But it's a tricky thing because a lot of times insurance companies view autism as a neurological disorder that can't be treated or as an educational disorder that can't be treated medically.
It sounds like a shuffle.
A little bit. So you really have to walk a fine line there. But what we're doing is simple behavior modifying strategies is what it's called under the billing code. And so we bill directly for that, and we make sure that we document everything that we're doing. Of course, we have data for everything we're doing, so that's not very hard. But we get whatever the child's carrier pays per visit is that's what we get.
What that doesn't address, though, is what happens in the educational system, because clearly what you stated earlier is it's not just your therapy that counts. Even if you were to then have some success in your setting and even help program a setting for a school has to be able to have the resources to follow through.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's where I think the rubber meets the road quite often, especially these days with so many cuts in education coming down the pike.
Yeah.
It's a huge disconnect, and we just hear so many unfortunate stories from families, and you know, you sympathize with the schools because they don't have, you know, either the training or the staffing to manage these problems, and you know, the caregivers don't even know kind of where what to ask for. And you know, we work for the families. You know, we're happy to go into schools and provide training for people or to provide them with a plan, but you know, the school can listen to us or not listen to us. You know, it's really up to them, but you know, we're here to help, and it's a huge disconnect.
It's also a major issue with resources and funding.
Absolutely.
It seems to me it's where we put our values as a society.
Yeah.
And clearly in times of financial stress, things that are really, in my mind, incredibly important get cut. And this is an example where kids with special needs often are the last ones to be cared for. What's your feeling about mainstreaming or kids that you see? Do you see them as benefiting from being part of a normal classroom setting, or would you advocate instead for them to remain separated?
I think our goal is to get every kid in the least restrictive placement they can be. Mainstreaming certainly has a lot of social benefits, and certainly from the other kids in the classroom, it teaches them about diversity and differences, and that differences aren't necessarily scary.
Let me clarify, I guess, for our listeners, when we say mainstreaming, we mean having a child in a regular classroom as much of their day as they can handle.
Right, yeah. And so a lot of our kids, that would be a good goal for them. Many of our kids academically could handle mainstreaming, but their behavior gets in the way. And so if their behavior gets in the way, then that's also disruptive to the other students in the classroom. But certainly for socialization, which is huge for autism, that's a very beneficial thing.
Yeah. Well, what I really would love to hear is what your sense is about what happens to kids like this. What's the natural history? I mean, I know that is a large spectrum with autism, and that's why it's now called autism spectrum disorder. Mm. What kind of a hope or future do you think many of these kids have, assuming they can go through our educational system with some degree of learning taking place?
Well, you know, there's a saying that if you've met one kid with autism, you've met one kid with autism. Because it's so variable.
Individual.
And that's really the key. We worked with a guy last year who I could see having a job and, you know, going to college. His issues were very mild. He had a very high-functioning form of autism, referred to as Asperger's syndrome. And certainly a child like that could work, live independently, so on and so forth. Many of the children that I work with have comorbid mental retardation, and so you would have many of the same issues with those kids as you would have with individuals who have had mental retardation. And so typically for folks like that, you look toward supported living, supported work environments, but certainly able to be part of the community. That would be the goal for all of these kids, and to have a behavior management plan in place to make sure that their behaviors stay under control.
Yeah. And, you know, really for us, it's, you know, it's about just setting them up to be as successful as possible, no matter what they do. And, you know,
within their own capabilities.
Exactly.
And fulfill their destiny in some way.
Yeah. And it's hard because I know a lot of times what you see in the media are people like Temple Grandin or the boy on American Idol. And, you know, sometimes I think, unfortunately, for some families, that it's a little bit of false hope. You know, and it's really sad. Not that they can't achieve, you know, great things or get a job, but I think that the severity of some of the families, and, you know, just like we talked about, the one little girl whose mom can't leave her house, you know, that's very different from somebody getting their PhD or being on a national television program.
It sounds like you've had some issues in this part of the country with people being somewhat suspicious about ABA, which is your methodology. How do we change perceptions in that regard, or is it possible to do?
I think it's definitely possible to do. I don't know why that is. That there's a history here that I don't understand. The best way to change is to show that it works, and so
and do good behavior analysis.
Do it properly, and we take a lot of pride in what we do, and we want to make sure that the kids and the families that we're serving have the maximum level of success, and that's obtained through doing what we do.
Well, Dr. Henry Rowan, associate professor, and Heather Cady, instructor, both from the Department of Psychiatry and you from the Department of Pediatrics as well. We're very, very grateful for your being here, for the work that you're doing, and for coming to talk to us today. I do hope that you do have the opportunity to expand your services. Clearly, there's a great need, not only in our community, but nationwide, and these kids really obviously can benefit from this kind of intervention. So once again, I thank you very much for coming in today. We have to take another short break, but there's more HealthLink on air ahead, so stay right there. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to FM News Radio 106.9 and 570 WSYR.